Welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 395. Five episodes until episode 400. Episode 395 features our essay on productivity. While productivity might not be the coolest subject, understanding the concept is critical to every company's and every worker's financial well-being. In the second column, Gene Hewson brings another entry in his Form Follows Function blog to the Software Process and Measurement Cast. Gene discusses the idea of accidental innovation. Gene suggests that innovation is not a happy accident, but is a result of process, structure, and technology that can enhance innovation, but just as easily get in the way. In our third column this week, Kim Priest, the software sensei, brings us a discussion of how software developers leverage assimilation and accommodation in the acquisition of knowledge. A powerful cast this week. Let's start with the essay on productivity. Productivity by Thomas M. Cagley Jr., Megan E. Cagley. Productivity is a classic economic metric that measures the process of creating goods and services. Productivity is the ratio of the amount of output from a team or an organization per unit of input. Conceptually, productivity is a simple metric. In order to calculate the metric, you would simply sum up the number of units of an item produced and divide it by the stuff needed to make those units. For example, if a drain cleaning organization of three people cleans 50 drains per month, their labor productivity per month would be 50 divided by 3, 16.6 drains per person per month. This metric is a sign of how efficiently a team or organization has organized and managed the piece of work being measured. There are four types of productivity. Each type of productivity focuses on a different part of the supply chain needed to deliver a product or service. The four types are: 1, labor productivity, which is the ratio of output per person. Labor productivity measures the efficiency of the labor in the transformation of something into a product of higher value. In software development terms, labor productivity is a measure of the efficient use of the effort needed to write and implement code. Capital productivity is the ratio of output, goods or services, to the input of physical capital. Improving physical capital, known as capital deepening, typically yields an increase in output. In software development, physical capital includes the equipment, buildings, or other items like computers needed to develop and implement the code. 3, material productivity is the ratio of output to the input of materials, also known as natural resources. In software development, there are very little material or natural resources that are used. Material productivity plays a larger role when considering the manufacture of hardware and software packages, like an ATM. Total factor productivity is not a simple ratio of output to input, but rather it is a measure that captures everything that is not captured as labor, capital, or material productivity. Factors included in total factor productivity include attributes like changes in general knowledge, the use of a particular organizational structures, management techniques, or return on scale. The components in TFP, total factor productivity, are often the sources of productivity changes in software development. Typically, three of the four types of productivity are important in a software development or IT department. Raw material productivity is less of a factor in software development. Most of the raw material is human knowledge and observable in labor productivity, or TFP. But it becomes more of a factor when the software product includes hardware manufacturing. Most software organizations, if they measure productivity at all, tend to focus solely on labor productivity. Labor productivity is often the easiest of the four productivity types to measure and understand. In many cases, organizations use changes in labor productivity as a proxy for measuring the impact of factors that would be more accurately reflected either as capital productivity or total factor productivity. The use of a proxy makes it more difficult to trace an input to a change in the amount of output. For example, if all employees get new computers, which is capital productivity, while the organization adopts a new team approach to software development, which is reflected in TFP, and the productivity increases, it will be difficult to determine the impact of each change if we only measure the proxy of labor productivity. This is not an esoteric discussion. If productivity improvement was used to justify either of the changes, each type of productivity is important in their own right. Each asks and seeks to answer a different set of questions. Labor productivity focuses on the impact of people on the number of products or services delivered. Labor productivity is useful for answering whether changing the mix of coders and testers on a team has an impact on the amount of completed software a team can deliver. Capital productivity would be useful in answering whether a new building, computer, or network helps or hurts the amount of goods and services delivered. Outputs. One of the most ubiquitous conversations that occurs in organizations is about productivity, although the word itself is rarely used. The conversation might be about the need to get more value from the software development budget, or the ability to deliver more new functions with the same staff. The concept of labor, capital, material, and total factor productivity are an undercurrent in these conversations. Even if the word productivity is not directly mentioned, there are several possible reasons why the word productivity is not used in polite software development company. Those reasons range from a mistaken belief that productivity concerns are reserved for blue-collar occupations, to the complexity of defining productivity in a software development and maintenance environments. Complexity is often the most pernicious reason that keeps productivity in the background during strategic conversations that affect products and jobs. However, with the exception of total factor productivity, the mathematical computation of labor, material, and capital productivity appears to be very straightforward. The equation for productivity equals output divided by input. The simplicity of the equation obscures the complexity hidden in the term productivity. Unwinding the complex concepts of measuring productivity begins with understanding and making three critical decisions that define the output side of the equation. The first step in unwinding the hidden complexity of measuring productivity is deciding which output process or value chain we will measure. Deciding what to measure begins with defining the decisions that measurement will support. Douglas W. Hubbard, in How to Measure Anything, wrote that we care about measurements for one of three reasons. Most organizations measure productivity so they can make specific key decisions. Understanding those decisions is critical to deciding which output of a process needs to be measured. For example, to establish whether improving the processing power available to software developers in the form of new laptops would increase productivity requires measuring the output of software development, functional software. Measuring the organization's whole value chain would be overkill and far less effective. Another example is a checking account that a retail bank delivers to a customer. The software required to account for checking transactions is part of the product and does not represent the full value chain needed to deliver a checking account. Organizations need to decide whether they are measuring productivity of the overall product or a component that is part of the value chain. The software is often not the ultimate product or service delivered to the organization's ultimate customer. Most organizations are not software product companies like Microsoft or SAP. Defining the decision or question that measurement supports is critical to deciding which output to measure. The second required decision is the definition of a unit of measure. For a wooden pencil manufacturer, pencils would be the output unit of measure. However, if the pencil manufacturer produces two models, to measure the combined productivity of both products, they would need some mechanism to normalize the output of both models. Software development has a similar problem, which the industry has solved using functional, physical, and relative measures. Function points, for example, lines of code, and story points for each one of those. In software development and maintenance, the functional software delivered is used to represent the whole process needed to deliver functionality. The whole process often includes training, documentation, support, DevOps, and more that some people may not recognize as part of the steps needed to deliver value from software. However, without the functional software, none of that stuff matters. Developing an agreement on a universal output measure for software is often fractious. The lack of agreement upon an output measure can generate all sorts of bad practices, such as equating productivity to the number of hours worked. The third decision is deciding which units of measure to count. Using the pencil manufacturer to illustrate this conundrum, if a mistake in manufacturing yields a pencil without the lead, the graphite in the middle for those who have never seen a wooden pencil, should that pencil be counted when computing productivity? The simple answer is no. The only units that count for productivity are those that are complete and fit for use. In agile software development, complete and fit for use would mean that functionality meets the definition of done and have been successfully demoed. The defective or unstable product is not counted, regardless of whether you're counting pencils, function points, or work orders. This puts the onus on the organizations to define and enforce the definition of done. Deciding why you are measuring the productivity is the first step of unwinding the complexity of the output side of the equation because it defines scope. Understanding the scope of what needs to be measured provides guidance on which unit of measure will be useful to support why you are measuring productivity. Understanding the unit of measure establishes boundaries for defining what the words done, complete, and fit for use mean so that we don't count output that is not useful. Shortcutting any of these discussions will reduce or erase the usefulness of measuring productivity. Inputs. Deciding on which outputs from an organization or process to count is never straightforward. The decision on the input side of the equation is often equally contentious. Three critical decisions shape what measures will be needed to supply the outputs used to calculate productivity. Deciding which inputs lead to an output is important. Every ounce of effort, raw material, and capital within a company is ultimately needed to deliver the organization's product and services. Yet, while calculating the total labor or capital productivity might be interesting to stockholders, it provides very little value for making process improvements within an organization. Framing the question or decisions is the critical first step in deciding which work leads to an output that we want to measure. For example, we can use the pencil manufacturer described in the output portion of the essay. In order to deliver a pencil to market, the overall value chain would include purchasing, logistics for raw materials, personnel functions for hiring, management, manufacturing, warehousing and shipping, research and development, marketing and sales. There is a pencil supply chain website that I would suggest that you go look at to just to get a hint of the complexity of the supply chain for something simple like a wooden pencil. If the manufacturer wanted to tune just the labor productivity of the assembly process for a classic number two pencil, the organization would need only to measure a small slice of the overall value chain. It begins with determining the output to measure, which leads to which inputs to measure. Begin all productivity exercises with some form of value chain mapping that shows how an organization transforms raw materials into a product and then delivers that product to its customers. Develop value chains so that the organization can get a full understanding of the process to see how they generate the greatest possible value for the organization and customer. Once you understand the flow, it is far easier to improve the whole or parts. Which components of overhead should be part of productivity calculations? Overhead represents cost and effort that can't be easily traced to an output. Using the pencil manufacturer example, the effort and cost of the maintenance personnel that sweep the plant on a nightly basis or middle and senior management are often considered overhead. Many software development organizations include only direct labor and costs when calculating productivity. Another normal practice is to apply a uniform allocation of overhead to each project. Both of these scenarios can and do cause significant distortions. For example, a troubled project often consumes significant amounts of management time and oversight, more input, than a well-run project requires. More input for the same amount of output yields lower productivity. Allocation is an easy process, but it is regressive. Allocation impacts the projects that are least reliant on non-direct labor and cost more than projects that are more reliant. In the scenario where one project implemented an application that leveraged an internal server farm used by several applications, while another leveraged the cloud for processing, allocating the server costs across all projects, even if they didn't use the servers, would distort capital productivity. Sourcing refers to purchasing work or other components for a product from an outside vendor. In the scenario where our pencil manufacturer has outsourced forming the wooden pencil barrel to an outside firm, labor productivity would increase because the process would use less internal effort. In this scenario, the increase in raw material will reduce raw material productivity. The question would be whether the improvement in labor productivity is better for the company than a reduction in raw material productivity. In software development, firms often reduce the cost of work while moving labor effort off an organization's books, thus obscuring overall productivity. For example, an organization that outsources technical design, coding, and development, and development-related testing can only measure the labor productivity of the work they retain control over. Therefore, if they measure labor productivity, they need to understand that it is only a partial picture. This realization often shifts the data needs from information about labor to raw materials or capital. Sourcing changes the decisions an organization can make to focus on the cost of raw material rather than labor productivity. Deciding what to measure is the second step in unwinding the complexity of productivity equation. The decision you are going to make based on productivity will guide you to whether you need to measure effort, cost of raw material, overhead, physical plant, or the cost of outsourced work. Each will tell a different story about the efficiency of a transformation of an input into an output. Total factor productivity. Labor, raw material, and capital productivity are easy concepts to understand. For example, labor productivity is the ratio of the products delivered per unit of effort. Increasing the efficiency of labor will either increase the amount of product delivered or reduce the amount of labor needed. Raw material or capital productivity follows the same pattern. The issue is that while labor, raw materials, and capital explain a lot of the variation in productivity, they do not explain it all. And in software development, other factors often contribute significantly to productivity improvement. Total factor productivity, TFP, is not a simple ratio of output to input, but rather a measure that captures everything that is not captured as labor, capital, or material productivity. Factors included in total factor productivity include attributes such as changes in general knowledge, the use of particular organization structures, management techniques, or returns on scale. The components of TFP are often sources of productivity changes in software development. Total factor productivity seeks to account for all of the inputs used to create a product, leaving a residual impact on productivity that isn't directly traceable to inputs. Conceptually, I find it easier to consider residual as the effect of non-direct inputs. The formula typically used to calculate TFP is the Slough residual, and that will be in the show notes and in the paper once it gets edited, so please request a copy of that. In essence, it's total output equals the total factor productivity times the capital input times calculating TFP is like removing parts of a picture to identify and appreciate what remains. Very, very, very few software development and maintenance organizations take the time to calculate TFP. But everyone involved in managing software development or actively involved in making and assessing change must understand TFP conceptually and the factors that it represents. The factors that comprise TFP are often very effective levers for changing software development and maintenance productivity. Several factors that contribute to TFP include technology change, general improvements in social well-being, changes in management approaches, Scrum perhaps, and reallocating resources from low productivity endeavors. Often, we can measure the impacts of the changes in these factors in other types of productivity indirectly. Technological change. Most of us have lived through the period governed by Moore's Law, and even if we did not personally get access to a new, faster processor every year, we were impacted by the increase in processing power. Networks became faster, and we can find new ideas to solve problems on the internet, which leads to more and more innovation in how work is done, therefore increasing productivity. Over the years, many in the software measurement field have noted a constant upward drift attributed to more efficient programming languages. For example, the venerable coding language COBOL, developed in 1959, has continued to evolve. IBM's current version is COBOL for X/OS. Each version made the language more powerful than the version before it. Technological change is a major contributor to productivity improvement in software development and maintenance. General improvements in social well-being. These type of changes include factors such as political stability, transportation, infrastructure, or general improvements in a country's or area's education system. Several organizations I talk with regularly source work in the Ukraine. During the height of the recent political problems, they saw a significant drop in both the amount and quality of functionality delivered. The same people were working on the code, and everyone was at work. However, the reduction in social well-being disrupted productivity. At an organizational level, companies often work hard to improve the social well-being of their employees and families. Google buses to move employees in and out of the core of San Francisco is a reflection of this need to improve productivity through increased social well-being. Changes in management approaches. Why does Scrum typically lead to higher productivity? Humans on teams are not generally improved, nor is the capital or raw materials. However, the change in management approach embodied in Scrum provides a basis for higher performance and increased productivity. For example, embracing Scrum as a management structure allows team members to make decisions faster, which improves the efficiency of the team. Reallocating resources from low productivity endeavors. Business Process Management, BPM, and Business Process Reengineering, BPR, are fields that improve work processes. They represent a field of operations research that optimizes processes by identifying what an organization does efficiently. Reducing low productivity activities allows organizations to spend money, effort, and other resources on developing and delivering the products and services they are efficient at delivering. The reallocation is one of the reasons continuous process improvement is powerful. TFP measures the impact of these factors and others. Unfortunately, measuring by subtraction is far less straightforward than just measuring labor productivity and pretending we're covering all bases. In software development, TFP represents many of the levers that organizations have to influence productivity. However, labor and capital productivity are often used as proxies to measure the impact of these changes. While the path from a change in management structure may not be direct, we can at least see the ripples caused by the change in other more straightforward measures. Interpreting the impact of indirect changes requires more careful analysis and often more explanation. Misapplication of productivity measures. Productivity is used to evaluate how efficiently an organization converts inputs into outputs. However, productivity measures can and often are misapplied for a variety of reasons, ranging from simple misunderstanding to gaming the system. Many misapplications of productivity measurement cause organizational behavior problems, both from leaders and employees. Five of the most common productivity-related problems are attributing team efforts to individuals. Most software development and maintenance activities are team efforts. Productivity measures usually reflect the output of the team doing the work and can't be ascribed to an individual. However, there is often a chronic need to ascribe output, whether good or bad, to an individual. For example, often productivity data is used in an individual's review and evaluation. This can lead to everyone trying to game the metric. The solution for this issue is just not to fall prey to using a team metric to measure an individual. Measuring productivity can reduce productivity. Measurement of productivity requires time and effort to count the inputs and outputs of a system. If an organization does not measure productivity, they could either create more output with the effort they have used to measure productivity or reduce payroll. In either case, leading to an increase in productivity. If the measurement of productivity is not directly tied to process improvement or cost avoidance, it will have no return on investment. Avoid overhead that does not deliver a significant ROI. The solution is to use productivity measures as part of process improvement or cost reduction programs. Goal plating and output to increase productivity. One of the most famous adages in management circles is that you get what you measure. Holding teams or individuals accountable for productivity above all else will lead to pressure to add features, even if not asked for, in order to increase the development output. This is often referred to as goal plating. Goal plating leads to delivering more functionality than is needed, often at the expense of needs that are higher value. One fix I recommend is measuring productivity, value, and customer satisfaction to ensure teams have more than a one-dimensional view of their performance. Optimizing local processes without regard to the overall system. The focus of any system is to deliver the most value possible and to improve over time. Maximizing the efficiency of part of a system may not translate to the whole system becoming more efficient. For example, I recently observed a large organization with multiple software teams that efficiently developed software. After developing and testing the software, the operations/implementation group performed a review and security testing prior to putting the implementation into production. The operations team had a 6-month backlog. While waiting for review, two changes in the last month had to be withdrawn because the market needed change before they ever made it to production. At the same time, a process improvement team was looking at ways to increase development productivity. Making the software development process any more efficient would only exacerbate the implementation group bottleneck. In the end, the organization reallocated three development teams to support the implementation function in working through the backlog and streamlining the process. As we identified when in our reread of the goal, systems only increase output if you improve the throughput of bottlenecks in the system. What doesn't get measured gets overused. Some organizations that focus on measuring productivity get very good at finding and utilizing resources that don't influence the input side of the equation. A classic issue is underreporting of effort in time reporting. For example, many organizations cap salaried employees' time entry at 40 hours per week, even though they are often working 60 hours or more. The overtime is effectively hidden, and because it's considered free, it gets used as much as possible. Therefore, there is often little pressure to measure the overtime until people start quitting. Any resource that is considered free will be overused. The last two behavioral issues are often the most common and can occur even when organizations don't explicitly measure productivity. Every organization, whether they explicitly measure productivity or not, wants software development to develop and deliver more functionality and cost less. Organizations that don't take a systems thinking view can actually increase cost and reduce real productivity, hurting the long-term efficiency of the organization when they are trying to have the opposite impact. Productivity is important because it reflects the efficiency of an organization in converting inputs into output. In the 20th century, we got used to productivity being a relatively simple concept. Steelmakers take raw materials, people, and machines and create steel. If we calculate productivity of a steelmaker, we would measure the amount of steel created, then divide it by the amount of raw material, cost of machines, or even the amount of effort needed. Calculating software productivity is not substantially different. Even in software development and maintenance, raw materials go in and a transformation occurs. Organizations care about productivity because an organization that is more productive will tend to outperform other organizations, helping to ensure organizational longevity. At a more personal level, we care about productivity because unless a team or an organization becomes more productive, there will be no incentive for increased pay, and perhaps an incentive to find someone else to do the work instead. Thoughts, comments, all welcome. Please feel free to shoot us an email at spamcastinfo@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 440-668-5717. We look forward to the conversation. Gene Houston, welcome back to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
For those of you that don't know, Gene Houston is the author of the Most Wonderful Form Follows Function blog. Gene, how long have you actually been writing on the Form Follows Function blog?
I started it in October of 2011.
Wow. That is fantastic. And by the way, that is at genehewson.wordpress.com. Links, obviously, in the show notes. Gene, today, why don't we start with a discussion of accidental innovation? I know that you've attacked accidental architecture before, but how does that relate?
Accidental innovation is really the same concept as what I tackled in accidental architecture. It's focusing way too much on down in the weeds and not looking at a big picture, just expecting things to automagically emerge. it just doesn't happen. It's not an accident. There's a lot of hard work that goes into making a system come together. And by the same token, a lot of hard work that goes into innovating.
If innovation isn't that lightning bolt and it's hard work, that flies in the face, obviously, of the guy who made Ivory Soap. Why do you say that it's hard work to be innovation? Does that mean that we actually have to have a process for it or to think about it before it hits?
Well, what's necessary is to be intentional about it and to understand that there's a lot of different factors that come together. It's not just having a good idea, because there's lots of good ideas out there. The problem you run into is whether it's a good idea for a particular context. Good example, Betamax. Absolutely wonderful, technologically superior format for videos, and never made it. There's, again, a lot of factors. There is technical aspect, there's the marketing aspect, there's the business aspect of creating a partnership. And innovation is kind of a funny thing, because people tend to think of it as just being change, and it's actually beneficial change that fits a context, that fits a market segment, that people will latch onto, and it kind of feeds on itself. But you've got to make that happen. You've also got to kind of surf the wave, because you really don't make it happen. You just kind of make the right moves to fit the environment that you're working in, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. One of the great quotes in this article, which I recommend everybody read in detail, was that everything ultimately connects with everything else and depends on everything else. Is that why it has to be intentional? That it can't be just unintentional?
Absolutely. It's one of those things, and really over the last few months, maybe even a year now, a lot of what I've been working on, the realization that, you know, all these systems interconnect. You've got software systems, you've got the social systems that create those software systems, you've got the social systems that maintain those software systems, you've got the social systems that make use of those systems, and you've got, you know, even broader picture, the social systems that make up the company and its customers, etc. So there's a danger that if you look at only one of those systems in isolation, that you handicap yourself in terms of meeting the needs of the bigger system.
Now, that blog post was sort of tied into a number of others. When you write these larger themes, and this is, I guess, more of a geeky technical blogging kind of question so that people can understand the wealth of information on form follows function. How do you think through and how do you connect all of these related kinds of concepts? I mean, this one, you listed roughly 12 posts in the same series as part of this article.
Right. I've been having a back and forth with Gregor Wikström, who is with Capgemini in Sweden. And to be honest, I forget now how we got started. Some combination between Twitter and our blog. But we started going back and forth, referencing each other's posts. And it's turned into this serial now. I think we're up to 18 between the two of us. And a colleague of his, Casimir Artman, who I believe is also, I believe he's Sogetti over in Sweden. But he's gotten into the mix as well. But it's been really gratifying. It's great being able to learn from and play off of other people in the industry. And to be honest, that's kind of been a big thing with form follows function from day one. I've riffed off of other people's works, added my own experiences, and it's been not only a sharing tool, but a learning tool for me.
So when you approach something like accidental architecture or accidental innovation, you're going through a learning process also. Do you think that comes across to the reader?
I hope so. I've actually got a why I write post some sitting on the back burner to my backlog of eventually I'm going to get around to it. And that's certainly a main theme for that. It's like, I fundamentally believe that the practice of software architecture, solution architecture, all the way up enterprise architecture, et cetera, has to be a continual learning process, and writing, interacting with others in the field, I think is a very valuable way to keep that learning process going.
So more people at the table, bigger and more diverse thoughts, bigger, diverse sort of challenges so that you grow. You finished up this article with a statement, basically, two-sentence statement. When the people involved are intentional about their purpose, the scales are tipped. Otherwise, we're left hoping for a happy accident. Is that still how you feel about accidental innovation?
Absolutely. You know, a good example of that, I believe the gentleman's name was Fleming, the discoverer of penicillin. And happy accident that he discovered it, but it was an intentional action on his part that he didn't throw it away. Because essentially what happened was he started with a failed experiment that was corrupted by this penicillin mold. And his first inclination was, this thing's been spoiled, I've got to talk. And then he realized that where the mold was, the bacteria wasn't. And so there was, again, a lot of hard work, a lot of study, experimentation, et cetera, that went into turning that happy accident into really one of the most important innovations of the 20th century. Sure, there's things that you run across serendipitously, but getting from that first happy accident to something that really makes a difference is not just a matter of chance.
I have definitely heard that, you know, fate favors those who are prepared.
Absolutely.
Gene Hewson, thank you for bringing your wonderful Form Follows Function blog to the Software Process and Measurement Cast. Thank you for sharing accidental innovation with us. Where can the listeners get in touch with you?
Certainly. Well, between the blog itself, genehewson.wordpress.com, I try to respond to all the comments there. I'm also on Twitter, Gene Hewson, and LinkedIn.
Thank you again, Gene. Until next time.
Thanks, Tom.
Hello, this is your software sensei, Kim Priest. I think it is fair to say that the dominant education theory today is a philosophy known as constructivism. The archetype of all constructivist thinkers is the late Jean Piaget. Piaget proposed many ideas, some of which have become sufficiently mainstream that most of us accept them as the way things are. For example, he proposed a means of acquiring information called assimilation. That involves adding information to constructs we already have. In short, we match reality to the frame in our mental model. On the other hand, he proposed a second concept, called accommodation, in which our new information no longer fits our mental model, and we must accommodate in order to modify our model to fit a new constructed reality. How do assimilation and accommodation work with software development? Consider the training of new software developers. Think of your first class in programming. In most cases, I would suggest we were given a syntax and told to solve problems with that syntax after being shown some examples of its use. In my own case, I know that the semantics or meaning of the code was of less interest at the time. However, most of us know that assigning the right side of the equal sign to a variable name is really storing the result of the right side in a memory location, a common flaw with high school student training. What if we had learned from the beginning the term binding, which is a more accurate description of what is actually going on? It would seem ultimately counterproductive to teach students how to do mathematics with a program and then expose them to statements that are nonsensical in standard mathematics, generating more confusion. At the risk of starting a language war, that is why I am sorry to see some prominent universities drop the use of the Scheme language or other Lisp-related languages. In Scheme, binding is a bit more obvious than, say, Python. In Scheme, the language is overwhelmingly self-consistent rather than looking bolted together, as with Python. However, this would be true of any consistent syntax. If anybody thinks Python is consistent, let them explain the use of len, the length function, to find the length of entities rather than using the object-oriented methods that hold for most of the other tools in the language. I teach Python to students, and every year I have to explain this inconsistency when students try to apply their newfound knowledge of methods to a string or a list. It is difficult to assimilate an inconsistent built-in function, thus requiring some level of accommodation in order to be successful. And yes, Python is a successful language, and the reason it's successful is because there's a library for just about anything. Anyhow, Piaget also proposed different levels of cognitive development. For example, teenagers are most commonly at the level of concrete operational, whereas many college students, although not all, are formal operational. That is, they are able to navigate abstractions. Some research indicates that only about 35% of high school graduates are formal operational seniors, suggesting a problem when they attempt to become software engineers at the university level. When we hire software engineers, it would be wise to include some probes for problem-solving ability before making the offer. We don't know whether they're concrete operational, formal operational, or what they are. We have to remain cognizant of the strictures, at least in the United States, of the Supreme Court decision in Griggs versus Duke Power Company, which did not allow discrimination through the use of testing by the employer if it were to the detriment of an historically oppressed category of people. However, if it can be shown that our testing or probing is utterly germane to the execution of the job, then we have met the intent of the Griggs decision. We are not trying to exclude any particular group, but rather trying to ascertain competence to perform the tasks we desire. We know this occurs regularly in the field of quality assurance because the American Society for Quality, ASQ, provides examinations for a variety of certifications. All states provide state board exams. We have requirements for engineers, accountants, lawyers, and doctors. Hence, in software quality, we want to select those individuals who have successfully developed through the waves of assimilation and accommodation to a point of being formal operational. These individuals should be able to prove competence without a hint of discrimination in violation of the law. One poor example, I once made the suggestion of using a test for coding in the C language for screening applicants. You would have thought I suggested something socially disgusting. This company went on to hire several individuals who interviewed well, but who could not perform the coding job competently. In fact, at least one of them couldn't do it at all. My recommendation is that we all review Griggs versus Duke Power before instituting a screening examination, and then proceed once we are satisfied that we are not guilty of discrimination. In regards to this decision, Chief Justice Warrenberger wrote, "Congress has placed on the employer the burden of showing that any given requirement must have a manifest relationship to the employment in question. I think we can do this ethically inappropriately and save ourselves the grief of hiring people not competent to the task or who are, in effect, untrainable. Until the next time, this is your Software Sensei.
In Reread Saturday News, we continue the read of Commitment, novel about managing project risk by Manson, Matz, and Geary. Buy your copy today and read along. Use the link to support the podcast. This week we tackle Chapter 5. Chapter 5 is a relatively short chapter, but exposes one of the critical mechanisms for how agile teams are able to self-organize and self-manage. Visit the Software Process and Measurement blog to catch up on past installments of Reread Saturday. In the next Software Process and Measurement cast, we begin our run-up to episode 400 with our interview of Mike Burrows. Mike and I talked about his game-changing idea of agenda shift. Agenda shift identifies opportunities for positive change in exploring an organization's alignment to values of transparency, balance, collaboration, customer focus, flow, and leadership. Along the way, we also revisited parts of his first interview covering Mike's book, Kanban from the Inside. Next week, we'll explore some of the upcoming conferences that we'll be at in the fall. If process improvement is a never-ending journey, why do so many people ask, when will we arrive? See you next week.